Money FM 89.3, best of prime time.
This is Prime Time on Money FM 89.3. I'm Rachel Kelly, and now it's time for our Powering Your Property segment, where we bring you the latest in real estate trends and news. In property headlines out this week, Australian home prices climbed by the most since August 2003 last month, as record low borrowing rates and government incentives lure more buyers into the market, raising fears of overheating. According to data by CoreLogic, nationwide house values surged 2.1% last month. Capital city prices gained about 2%. That was led by Sydney and Melbourne. Over in China, growth in new home prices, however, eased slightly in February as demand slowed over the Chinese New Year and some major cities clamped down further on speculative buying. That's according to data from China Index Academy, one of the country's largest independent real estate research firms. It's said that new home prices in 100 cities rose 0.2% for the month of February from a month earlier. Now, bringing you back home here to Singapore, according to Knight Frank's wealth report, it highlights that Singapore has become one of the world's most sought-after locations for buying investment homes, as its safe haven reputation has been further strengthened by successfully managing the coronavirus pandemic and supporting businesses. Now, M&G Real Estate is recognized as one of the world's leading property investors. The firm invests across all sectors with a portfolio that spans some 29 countries. And to find out more about the trends that they're watching in the market and how M&G is positioning its portfolio, we're joined today by Jonathan Tsu, and he's the head of Research Asia at M&G Real Estate. Jonathan, welcome back.
Hi, Rachel. I'm happy to be back. Thanks again for having me back on your show. I'm very happy to be here.
I hope you've been keeping well, Jonathan.
Yeah, I've been keeping very well. I think we're very lucky to be in Singapore, where the pandemic has relatively been well managed, and we're able to return to a more normal life compared to, you know, what's going on around the world. So I'm very happy to be here and, you know, very, you know, enjoying life, starting to enjoy more and more.
Optimistic start to the interview, Jonathan. And just picking up on that last point about being here in Singapore, as mentioned, there's a report that's come out that's highlighted Singapore has become one of the world's most sought-after locations for buying investment homes. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the trends that you're watching? What are some of the things that you're seeing as we further progress into 2021? And as you say, things start to pick up a little bit on all fronts.
I would say, just starting off with that news report that you mentioned about Singapore, and I would say that is a rising trend. I think Asia Pacific developed market through this pandemic has really shown their ability to better manage through crisis. And, you know, it is giving investors globally, either you're in Europe, UK or US, more confidence about the resilience of investing into Asia Pacific. Aside from the high growth that you're likely to get from the region, now you're adding resilience to, you know, to your portfolio if you diversify more of your allocation to Asia. So we're definitely seeing that type of interest, you know, strong interest or growing interest from investors around the world looking at Asia. So I'm not surprised to hear that, you know, house prices are gaining in Singapore from foreign interest. But in terms of other themes that we are really focused on, and I would say these are longer term themes, I would say there's three key words that start with D and then one that starts with E. So the three Ds are demographic, digitalization, and then globalization. And then the E, of course, is ESG. Now, in terms of demographics, we are seeing millennials and Gen Z rising in terms of becoming the main consumer group.
Right.
The older generation, a lot of them are, you know, becoming older, they're getting ready for retirement. And, you know, I think in terms of what they're looking at, it's more about age, you know, about medical and all these things. Then there's digitalization, you know, even today, you know, we're speaking through Zoom. A lot of the meetings that, you know, we've been having throughout this pandemic has been through various video conference providers. And, you know, when we can't go to the theater, what do? We turn on Netflix or HBO whatever. And now Disney Plus is also jumping on that, you know, on that streaming service.
Too many platforms to subscribe to now, Jonathan.
Yeah. And aside from that, you know, the cloud of things, all our memories, our photos, our videos, documents, everything is stored, you know, virtually and, you know, in some remote location that we know probably never seen or driven by. And, you know, it's also allowed us to shop virtually. So we're able to shop online. And then deglobalization, I would say that is a trend that is really brought upon, you know, or at least accelerated by the pandemic.
You've mentioned this triple D and an E, and as you mentioned, the pandemic has really brought about many changes. You've spoken about Netflix, consuming content from the comfort of your own home. I also do my groceries online and take other measures to social distance as much as possible. But talk to us a little bit more about your opinion on brick and mortar when it comes to, say, for example, retail properties or industrial properties. What are some of the shifts that you're seeing there? Perhaps we can start with retail, because from what you're saying, you're starting to allude a little bit more into perhaps omni-channel platform services provided by retailers. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. And, you know, I'll start off by saying very simply, retail is not dead. It does, however, needs that transformation. The adoption of e-commerce, as we all know, throughout the pandemic really accelerated. And e-commerce sale of retail quickly grew to 20% plus amid all the physical restrictions. And this was good. You know, you correctly say this was great for logistic warehouses where the e-commerce players are, you know, moving their goods in and out of there. And essentially, consequently, it was bad for brick and mortar. But there's still a very important role for physical retail going forward. And it will continue to serve as a touch point for consumers to look, see, and feel, or simply experience a product. It becomes more of a marketing presence. And it also would start to serve as a point for logistics of delivering goods to consumers to lower the overall logistics expense for retailers. So it becomes, you know, convenient for consumers to go into the shop and pick up the goods. And I think retailers can really add to that by providing some sort of discount for consumers that go pick up the goods inside the store and, you know, have more eyes on other stuff that they have to offer.
And moving on from shopping centers and logistics, Jonathan, let's talk a little bit about office space, because, you know, companies across the globe are looking to downsize their office space. For example, I was reading an article last week that HSBC announced plans to nearly halve its office space globally over the long term. People are looking at alternative ways of working, a mix of working from home and working from the office. So talk to us about how office spaces, as we know, are changing. Are they becoming irrelevant? And what does that really mean for property developers and investors such as yourselves? Could it be could it be that office spaces are no longer so-called office spaces, but what you would term as workspaces? I know you've spoken in the past about creating creative, collaborative workspaces as well.
Yeah, I would say the future of office remains bright, at least in our house view, because collaboration remains key, as we've stated before. And the efficiency of working together is quite underrated, I think, especially through the pandemic. Today, I'm working in office, and I typically come back to the office 1 to 2 days and maybe 3 days a week. And it's just easier to have these spontaneous conversations that lead to solutions to problems that you may have or you may be thinking about, rather than through the structured time constraints, schedule, you know, video calls or, you know, different type of Zoom calls. And also allows for colleagues to really, you know, look after each other. We look for signs of fatigue and burnout, and really to be there to offer help and care, because we're actually able to see this person and how they're moving around the office, how they physically look, you know, they're the way they're carrying themselves. And you can take Singapore, for example. Again, the CBD, from day one of me started slowly coming back to office, you know, either, you know, looking around at the hawker center or going to the restaurants around, it's slowly picking up that life again. Office workers are coming back to the office to really increase, you know, they realize that they need that efficiency and productivity through face-to-face interactions. And, you know, even if that means, you know, increased transport time to get from point A to point B, you know, from their homes to the office. And I also feel, you know, this is a bit worrying, is that the blurring line between work and home is not great for wellness. You know, there's no clear distinction between when office hours really start and when it really ends. And I feel people are increasingly becoming burnt out, sitting at home alone in isolation. And it's just leading to their mental detriment in a way.
I think so. I think it's a really important point as well, Jonathan. And just adding on to that and talking about wellness as a key trend, the E that you mentioned, ESG, yes. And taking a look at Singapore's recent budget announcement and green plan, greening and the environment, nature, it's all very important for wellness, isn't it? People talk about nature bathing, a way to de-stress, unwind. Talk us through what this means for property investors. What are some of the things that you're looking at when it comes to ESG, I guess, both on the development of a particular project, but also looking at the way that a project is structured when it comes to perhaps incorporating some of these wellness aspects or green elements that perhaps tie in all of these points that you're raising, very relevant points that you're raising about this.
In 2019, MNG Real Estate did make a commitment to be net zero carbon by 2050. Mm. And, you know, even in terms of the buildings within the portfolios globally, 34% of them do have green certificates, meaning they have some sort of energy efficiency, the way they manage waste and, you know, dispose of it. And the goal really is by 2030 to reach 90%. So 90% of buildings under, you know, the assets under management will be, you know, will have this green certificate. And, you know, above that, we've reduced carbon emissions in the real estate by 33% since 2012, 2013.
Wow, okay.
And again, the goal by 2030 really is to implement more mechanisms to drive occupier net zero progress, as well as to source electricity through 100% renewable sources. And these are all the strong commitments that M&G is making. On top of that, I would say, you know, in terms of our investment process, we're also, you know, really looking at ESG, really, you know, really stressing the importance of it. If a building doesn't have the right credentials, you know, it's less likely to be passed through the investment process. So it really needs to have these green features, either, you know, solar panels, either the way they treat water, either way they use source electricity. All these are criteria that we're, you know, slowly but surely implementing into the investment process to ensure that the investors of the portfolio are getting a greener and greener portfolio over time. And I really feel that these green buildings also will be more resilient going forward. Mm-hmm. And you may ask, you know, how can a green building be more resilient? I think the occupiers themselves, let's say you are a bank or you are, you know, some businesses, and you have your own green requirements, you will be, I think it will look better if you are, you know, optically for you to be in these green buildings that's, you know, also in line or aligned with your own, you know, company strategies around how you attain ESG. So I would say going forward, it's going to be a requirement for occupiers to be in these green buildings. And therefore these buildings, you know, from an income perspective, from a leasability perspective, will become more resilient, and that will give investors more resilient returns. And I really feel that is the wave of the future. So the 2020s, you know, all the way to 2030 and beyond, is really going to be that decade, you know, for us to really focus on ESG.
Wonderful. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing all your insights with us today.
Well, thank you very much again for having me. I'm happy to come back again anytime.
Wonderful. We've been speaking with Jonathan Su, Head of Research Asia at M&G Real Estate, right here on Primetime on Money FM 89.3.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.